Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me this week are Jeff Renke and Anna Wells. We're the editors of Manufacturing.net and Industrial Equipment News, and we each have more than 15 years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we cover the five biggest stories in manufacturing and discuss the implications they have on the industry going forward. But before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You could also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You could also subscribe to our daily newsletter. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. And subscribe to us on YouTube at IEN Magazine so you get a notification whenever we go live every Thursday. Anna, how are you doing this week?
Doing great, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Keeping it together. Jeff, how are you doing this week?
I'm good, David. I feel no pain this week. How about yourself?
Like 70% of my body pain-free, but that other 30% a lot. Turns out, like, you don't realize, like, when you're recording a podcast, you don't realize, like, how much you're kind of just dancing behind that mic when you're standing. And, like, every tiny movement just has my knee going, like, something's not okay.
Yeah.
Just a lot of English in there right now. A lot of English. And probably a lot of legacy scar tissue, too. All right. Well, before we get started with our first story this week, we have a word from our sponsor. Once again, it's Rockwell Automation. This week's episode is brought to you by Rockwell Automation, which wants to help you gain unlimited HMI visualization options. You know, I should have rewritten this thing after the debacle that happened last year, but let's give it a shot. This new video podcast, now available on demand, highlights Rockwell's recent rollout of FactoryTalk Optics, a new cloud-enabled HMI product. According to the company, this latest offering centers on improving processes, efficiency, and deliverables by providing new levels of collaboration, scalability, and interoperability. In the podcast, Anna and Jeff break it down. They break down the webinar. Jeff, a note to the listeners and viewers as to why they should register for this breakdown of the webinar.
Well, I think this technology, when you look at all of these interfaces and how they're evolving, it's becoming more and more such a bigger part of plant floor operations. And being able to have a better visualization of what's going on either in the cell or throughout the facility is just becoming more and more important. And it's just such an important building block into so many of those sort of next generation technologies that we want to see implemented throughout manufacturing. So it's good insight. It's really interesting in what Rockwell is doing there and the solutions that they're offering. So.
Nice. Anna, did you learn anything?
Of course. And I think Jeff nailed it right there. I mean, this technology is so important and you might as well use it. It's there. You know?
Yeah. Well, I'm evolving too. That's why I went really slow with interoperability.
I think, were you practicing like during the week or?
Probably.
That's how he heard it. It's how he hurt his knee.
Yeah. I was just going up and down the stairs saying interoperability. And then I stumbled with my words. I stumbled as well. Three flights of stairs later on a softball field and boom, knee gone. All right, our first story this week. Coal industry on track to shed 1 million jobs. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, U.S. coal industry will see nearly a quarter of its operating plants close by 2030. And it looks like a lot of raw material producers like China and India kind of see the writing on the wall. According to Reuters, hundreds of mines are on track to close in the next few decades. Citing research conducted by the U.S. firm Global Energy Monitor, the global coal industry is expected to lose 1 million jobs by 2050. The problem isn't the loss of jobs, it's that most of the mines have no planning underway to transition to a post-coal economy. If nothing is done, the gap would be immense. Especially in China, where the industry employs 1.5 million people. Some say that if we meet current objectives to limit global warming, there will be a need for just 250,000 miners worldwide. Anna, kind of a slow-moving potential catastrophe coming towards us.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And I think people know that the writing has been on the wall for the coal industry for a while. I mean, we're seeing some of the shifts in policy and usage and all of those things. ESG, it's kind of encouraging people to move in a different direction. Of course, this forecast applies to global industry, including coal mines, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. So it's not just about coal-fired plants in the U.S., but mining everywhere, which is a lot of that is located in India and China. But I think there are some interesting takeaways about the transition piece, about it, like, you know, turning some of these jobs into other ones in adjacent green industry. You know, there's the U.S. Department of Energy says that there's just over 8 million jobs in renewable energy today. And that in 21 and 22, energy jobs grew faster than overall U.S. employment. So that's really interesting. Yeah. But there's more to it, I think, than just is a job being created in green energy for every coal job's demise, right? That doesn't necessarily match those workers with those jobs. So I think the question becomes, is it feasible to do that, to transition these specific people and these specific communities that rely on coal now to clean energy industries? And the answer, according to a report that Forbes published last year, is yes, it is feasible. The University of Michigan did some research that basically amounted to a conclusion that green energy firms said that presence of a workforce with the right skills and competencies to facilitate sustainability projects was the leading factor when choosing a country to invest in. And while locating where the workers are added some cost to that scenario, in many cases, it appears to be worth it to them. So especially if there's skill redevelopment taking place. Obviously, you can't rely on the companies who are operating in the coal industry to take that on, right? It's got to be coming from either, I think, federal, state, local programs that are intent on preserving those economies at a local level, but also those new companies that are bringing those green jobs in. They seem to believe, based on this research, that that investment is going to pay off in the long run. So I don't know if the coal companies not having a plan is really the problem, because there are plans to leverage these workers. They're just, it's coming from these other clean energy firms. If the coal companies determine that their interest in those investments, you know, they want to have an interest in those investments going forward, great, you know. But if they don't, it looks like there are plenty of other firms, stakeholders, what have you, that are interested in kind of scooping up this talent. And hopefully that bodes well for these communities that are currently invested in coal, both in the U.S. and worldwide.
We've run a number of stories actually about how trying to retrain these legacy workers in coal into new green energy jobs and how there's a lot of opportunity there, but it is kind of like a weird catch-22 as to like who's going to kind of take the ball and run with it. Mm-hmm. Just because what we see in automotive is that there's a clear incentive, right? Automakers are transitioning from combustion engines to electrics, and they need to make that happen internally. It's just kind of an interesting scenario where trying to figure out who's gonna upskill them, right?
Yeah, and I think it makes sense that it sounds like these companies, you know, whether it's solar or wind or whatever, you know, say they do want to set up in West Virginia because they have this captive workforce of people that are ready to go as long as they get that training. Those companies say, according to the research, that they're willing to do it because it's worth it to them in the long run.
Yeah. Jeff, do you think, in your opinion, who should do the training? Who should, you know, should it just be on the worker, or if they want to transition to a new market, they should pursue the education themselves? Should it be kind of a hybrid mix?
I think it's on the company,
yeah.
Whoever. And I think that's what's where the biggest debate with a lot of these alternative energy options come into play, is because where does the investment come from? Does it come from the government? Does it come from the community? Does it come from the company that is ultimately going to reap the benefits of all of that investment, whether it's labor, technology, whatever the case may be? So it's, to me, I always think it always falls on the company itself, mm-hmm. and to you know, sort of show or sell the benefits of becoming more aligned with what they're doing. Honestly, with this one, though, when it comes to coal, I think the U.S. is in pretty good shape, to be honest, when you look at these types of jobs and who it's going to impact the most. I'm going to throw a lot of numbers here, so if it gets to be too much, just shut me down here. But the U.S. is the third leading coal producer in the world, okay, about 728 billion tons. They employ about 56,000 workers at mines to do this, okay? Mm-hmm. The next one is India, about 761 billion tons, but they employ about 10 to 12 times more workers to get only about 20 billion more tons.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the scale isn't there.
Yeah.
Then when you look at China, which does about 3.7 trillion tons of coal, again, as the article referenced, that's about 1.5 million workers. So about five times more coal than the U.S., but about 25 times more workers.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see there's an element there where the U.S. coal market, as we've been shutting these places down, we've been getting more efficient with the number of people employed. We know we've gotten a lot cleaner. We're not where we want to be, obviously. And we know probably, and maybe it's a little stereotypical in the thought process, but we know China and India are not worried about the same environmental and safety regulations traditionally that we have here.
Or human concerns.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the investments have not been made there from a workforce development perspective. So when we look at these job losses that are going to be experienced globally, yeah, we're going to see them here in the U.S., but I think it's going to be more gradual, and it's going to be something that we'll be able to absorb without too much pain.
Okay. Yeah.
Globally, it's going to be very different. I think China and India in particular are going to see some really massive impacts to their economy because this is such a big part of what they're doing. When you talk about an industry employing 1.5 million people.
Yeah.
Okay, and there's going to be efficiency gains that should be realized there just because there's going to be a reduction in the need, ideally, for that product. It's going to be interesting to see what happens in those economies. The other thing I think we need to realize here, too, is coal is used in a lot of other places other than just heating and for energy applications. It's used in producing steel. It's used actually in producing some pharmaceutical and medical products. It's used in making carbon fiber. So we are still going to need coal mines. We're not going to shut them all down. But I think in the U.S., we've shown how we can become sort of labor efficient in extracting that resource and make it still marketable. It'll be interesting as we see places like China and India potentially losing all this manpower. What's that going to do to price? And does it actually help maybe some of those working in those coal mines actually have better paying jobs?
Yeah.
The price of the product goes up and there's less global availability. You know, it'll be interesting to see what happens with that marketplace.
Maybe safer jobs as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe. Training has been something that's been coming up quite a bit when I've been talking to people in the industry. Just about there's still like such a demand for training out there. And it kind of reminds me of like the skills gap stuff that we talk about where we think there are a lot of programs out there to get more people interested and involved in the engineering and manufacturing industries. But because we kind of cover it every day, it seems like there's more of it than there actually is. And training is actually still a huge problem where I've talked to some of these small and mid-sized manufacturers about how they're willing to pay their employees to go and do the classes during company time. And now they can't find community colleges or places to actually train them. And it's just, it's been a real issue where we have this problem with the skills gap. We also have a problem with like how to bridge that, especially if you can't do it internally. And I've had conversations with people talking about how like, they will even supply like a retired worker to teach the class to the new employees. And I'm just like, all right, that's, I mean, it's an interesting solution, well, but
what I would always challenge people there is, are you telling them why?
Yeah.
It's great to say, hey, we need you to do this. Okay. Or this is available to you. But if you're not selling it, if you're not telling them the long-term benefits of it, I think that's where there's sometimes that break. In the message.
Well, no, I think that, so that was the new part for me is that there's employee buy-in, but there aren't, the program isn't available locally to get the training. So it's trying to figure out that logistical part of it.
I see.
All right. Our next most popular story this week. Failure of a single component caused seaplane crash that killed 10. The NTSB last week confirmed that a mechanical issue caused a seaplane crash that killed 10 people near Washington last year. A single component of a critical flight control system failed during the September 4th, 2022 flight, causing an unrecoverable near-vertical descent into the Puget Sound's Mutiny Bay. Some 85% of the aircraft was recovered from the ocean floor weeks after the crash. And investigators determined that an actuator that moves the plane's horizontal tail and controls the airplane's pitch had become disconnected. The failure would have made it impossible for the pilot to control the airplane. The plane was a DHC-3 Otter, a turboprop operated by Renton-based Friday Harbor Seaplanes. NTSB Chair Jennifer Homendy said, quote, "The Mutiny Bay accident is an incredibly painful reminder that a single point of failure can lead to catastrophe in our skies. The NTSB recommended that the FAA and Transport Canada require operators of DHC-3s to install a secondary locking feature so, quote, this kind of tragedy never happens again. Jeff, I feel like that's just the starting point. And it's weird because in an industry, and we still see, you know, a fringe amount of like safety failures where we talk about, like, you know, it's the 5% of bad actors that we hear about the most. But in manufacturing, it seems like there are a lot more redundancies. So if there is one failure, something else catches it, right? So it's kind of, you know, when we talk about a plane, you would think that there was just more than one, you know, something that doesn't catch a component failure like that.
Yeah, you know, we've sort of been raised in this sensor-rich environment where there's always something setting off a warning light telling you what's going on. And it doesn't look like that was the case in this instance.
Right.
It also seems like this is just something that's never really happened before. They've never encountered this situation. All the safety bulletins were basically sent out afterwards, you know, mm-hmm. and telling everybody that now this is something you need to double check. They've implemented the equivalent of like a lockout, tagout type of device now on these actuators. Whenever we have these types of stories, it kind of takes me back to basic training where we'd be taking apart the M16, the rifle, and there's one part where you're taking apart the bolt with the firing pin, and there is a small piece of metal in there called the firing pin retaining pin. It's about as long as my fingernail. Mm-hmm. It is very small, but it basically holds the firing pin into the bolt. Without this pin, this little piece of metal, you can't fire the weapon.
Yeah.
So it was always reinforced to us, yes, this is a 69-cent pin that will not allow this $800 weapon system to work, mm-hmm. you know, and it's reinforced. They didn't let us carry extra ones, so we had to strip these things in the field. So it was always amazing that we never lost one of these firing pins or these retaining pins. But it was that attention to detail that reinforced everything along the lines with the training, and it's sort of that way here when you hear about some of these things, paying attention to all these little things, constantly monitoring and checking. Now, again, this was a unique situation. This had never been encountered before, and you don't want to sidestep the tragedy that mm-hmm. happened here. But one of the things that I worry about, because there is a suit now going on against the manufacturer of the plane, as well as the service provider.
Yeah, the operator.
The operator of the service, of the, what do they call it? The, I don't know, the flight, I guess, the service.
The Friday Harbor seaplanes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I just worry sometimes, even though I can appreciate where the victims' families are coming from, when we have this type of legal element, how is that going to impact transparency in terms of understanding what went wrong going forward?
Yeah.
If other manufacturers then see, okay, yeah, NTSB got in there, but they found out stuff, and now, even though it wasn't, we don't really feel like we did anything wrong, now we're going to be facing all this legal ramification because they found out it was a defect in the plane. Mm-hmm. That just worries me, because at the end of the day, that is what is most important after the tragedy. Obviously, we can prevent it. That's what's most important. But in order to prevent future ones, we need to understand what happened. Yeah. And I just worry too much when we get into the weeds on some of the legalities that that's going to be lost.
Yeah.
Because we have now learned from this so much in terms of what can be done going forward. The other thing that's interesting, when you look at the history and the legacy of this plane, it's been in a lot of crashes, but most of the time it's been operator error is what the NTSB has pointed to, not the plane itself. So the plane itself has a pretty good record.
Yeah. Well, Anna, talking about the plane, it seems like it's been in service for a long time. And part of the lawsuit is blaming the, quote, antiquated aircraft design. But it kind of raises the point, like, once you manufacture something and it's in the field for so long, like, how long are you, you know, I guess, like, as long as the machine or the aircraft is in service, you're still kind of on the hook for liability, even if it's been in operation for like 30 years.
Yeah, I'm not sure about this. You know, the lawsuit's overarching claim right now is that the plane maker is responsible due to an antiquated design.
Yeah.
With a single point of failure, which the single point of failure, it, you know, you understand that the antiquated design, that's the part I'm getting tripped up on too, is the language there, because if you look at equipment like an airplane, mm-hmm. you know, that tends to have a lifespan in the field of decades.
Yeah.
You know, so if this flies in court, like, does that set a precedent that creates a world for every product that, you know, if a new, better version is in existence, does everything before it need to be recalled because they've made the design better?
Yeah.
You know, because what is an antiquated design? You know, just the previous.
It feels very opinion based as opposed to technically or fact based. Yeah,
I agree. And, you know, it makes it makes more sense to me that if the flaw is pinpointed, that this becomes more of an inspection issue. Like we saw, I mean, we discussed this recently about that Boeing jammed tail parts. How they issued bulletins after they determined that this was a problem. And then it became sort of on the operators to make sure that, that you know, they had that message and they were following those protocols at that point. Obviously, there's fear that that message doesn't get through, which is what happened in that case. But I don't know if the... It doesn't make sense to me, I guess, to come after the manufacturer for producing something that is... not as good as it could have been if it were made today. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, you know, that that applies to so many things.
Yeah.
So that was a tough one for me to reconcile. Obviously, it was a very tragic case. I think one good thing that came out of it, we were talking last week about the NTSB adding depth of staff, trying to add some efficiencies to that agency. I appreciated in this case that NTSB, within weeks of this accident, when they determined what they thought happened, they sent out some guidance based on their preliminary findings. They didn't wait until a year later when they had the final report in hand to offer those up. Yeah. And so people were acting on that information pretty much right away.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say kudos to them on that for really taking that and running with it.
So there are about, according, no, this is according to Viking Air, there are about 450 of the original 844 Twin Otters still in service today. And these are planes that were made between 1966 and 1984. Mm-hmm. Like, that is just a long time to be in service. And you're right. Like, we have a legacy of how when we find a problem, kind of communicating that problem. I mean, it's not the best system typically, but communicating that problem to interested parties so they can hopefully act on it. But it's, there's still always going to be what happens when it's the first time, mm-hmm. you know, and that's, and it's just an unfortunate situation that is going to continue, you know, because there are going to be unforeseen failures. So the lawsuits allege that the defendants and their subsidiaries should have maintained and inspected the aircraft, had a duty to ensure a safe flight. And yes, they did have a duty to ensure a safe flight, but I don't know how you inspect the aircraft and catch something that's never been seen before, you know, mm-hmm. especially when it comes down to a single component like an actuator. You know, I don't even know if, like, you were always talk about the tribal knowledge of, like, legacy maintenance staff. I don't even know if, like, the maintenance guy catches that, you know?
Yeah, you'd have to be looking for it, it feels like.
Pretty close. All right, our next most popular story this week. Price cuts mean Tesla's Model 3 is on par in terms of cost with the Toyota Corolla. Tesla has been cutting prices for the better part of a year. According to Bloomberg, the carmaker has reached a new low. After Tesla's latest round of price cuts, the base Model 3 sedan now starts at just $39,000, $8,700 under the average sale price of a new car or truck in the U.S. The Model Y SUV is priced $3,700 below. It's called price parity, and it's been a goal for every automaker who hopes that they can reach scale and lower the price for customers wary of the high price tag of EVs. Many market analysts saw this coming, by and large, in the or see this still coming in the next several years. But if Tesla is there now, will this create a big competitive advantage for the company that's led the way on electric cars? Gary Black, one fund manager, believes the most recent price cut alone will come with an annual cost to Tesla of $1.2 billion starting next year. Other investors believe that the price cuts are Tesla's way of propping up demand after Elon Musk has become viewed as a rather contentious figure in the public eye by some. Either way, they're likely to work at driving sales. When the $7,500 tax credit is added to the new low base price of the Model 3 and its fuel savings, ownership costs become on par with that of the Toyota Corolla. Now, Anna, I know that you put the story together, and I mean, there was a little bit of debate online as to like how comparable it was with the Corolla, because people were like, you know, shaving a few thousand dollars here or there. But when it comes to an entry price for an EV, and we're talking like $30,000, that is just something we've never seen before.
Yeah. And to be clear, the story says that that its ownership cost becomes on par with the Toyota Corolla. So you're talking about cost to buy minus the tax credit minus what they called fuel savings.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, whether you, I looked at that as like an example that was intent on proving a point, but that's where that data came from.
Okay.
And that was,
well, I mean, that makes sense. The life of the vehicle is going to cost you less overall.
Yeah.
Or the same.
The same. Yeah. So, yes, there's a lot here. You know, we can anticipate that this might provide a bump in sales for Tesla, but that to me looks like something that is probably very temporary, as has come with the previous price cuts in the last year. The sustenance of that, like, it's not really been sustained. Auto News, who cited Experian data, just reported that Tesla's U.S. EV market share has dropped more than 7 points so far in 2023.
Okay.
And that registrations for its high-end vehicles, including the Model X and the Model Y, have dropped by double-digit percentages. At first, I think when the price cuts started to come, it seemed to me anyway that like Elon Musk was maybe just toying with Ford a little bit and pushing at its competitors to make them...
try to match.
Yeah, like get a little uncomfortable. It was a way of disrupting the market a little bit, and I think leveraging their position that they had. And that's a strategy that would make sense if you were the top player in the industry. You were well ahead of your competitors in terms of scale, which Tesla is. Unfortunately, I think those price cuts need to be paired with high sales volume, right? That's basic economics, that your, you know, lower margin items, you need higher sales volume to make up for that. That's not happening here for Tesla, as the data is showing us. So you worry that the future has some challenges in store. There's been endless discussion on this panel and more broadly about the brand impact of Elon Musk, the Twitter acquisition, you know, are brand loyalists reacting positively to Musk's public persona, or has it been a brand hit? A lot of people argue that it's been a brand hit. Then add to that these comparisons to the Toyota Corolla. I think like Tesla has leverage as being somewhat of a luxury brand. And if they cut prices to the point where they're on par with these less sexy vehicles, do they lose a bit of that allure, maybe? The prestige that comes with owning a Tesla? And without that very differentiating factor, does Tesla lose some of that advantage of being first to market and just become one of many EV makers who is like battling it out to get buyers? Mm-hmm. I don't know. It just seemed like now there's this added pressure to sell more vehicles on top of that, because you need to turn a profit. And I don't know. Like, I don't think this is a dead end. Like, they can, there are lots of things that Tesla can do to modify this. They could reverse course. They could do something different before they risk what I think could be maybe irreversible brand damage eventually. But to me, this race to the bottom on price is a losing battle. It doesn't make sense to me. I don't know how long Tesla can do this and still be Tesla. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a big challenge to continue forth on this path.
Well, he was just trying to create the new town square for America, or for the world, for the world. And I mean, it is an interesting problem that they have where, I mean, a lot of these are also because of the goals that Elon Musk has set for the company. When you come out and say that sales are going to rise by 50% every year, you know, all of a sudden you're beholden to stuff like that. And shares, or your share price moves up or down based on this like kind of wild claim that you made, or people thought was wild at the time. And I don't know, Jeff, I mean, is this a natural transition for Tesla where, okay, it was first in, it was first seen as more of a luxury buy, but now is it got to be a volume play just to make sure that you have more Teslas on the road?
It can be, going back to Anna's point, which I agree with 100%, it can be a volume play, but you need to have the volume.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't. It's very clear. I mean, we've talked about this before in terms of how they scale according to all the other major automakers. They're not even close, okay? Now, when it comes to the EVs, yes. And, you know, looking at some of the numbers over the last couple of years, you know, you said a 7% drop in the EV market. That's about what I saw, too. I actually thought it would have been more because you've seen all the other major players step up the number of vehicles that they've made and sold. But along that line, Tesla has also steadily improved and increased. So the timing seems very weird to me in terms of this. We're going to talk a little bit about vehicle prices here in a little bit and how they've changed over the last couple of years. To go this far is I don't understand it. I think it does damage the brand a little bit. It does make people take a step back and go, what's going on there? Because you almost need to justify this a little bit, whether it's finding efficiencies in your supply chain, understanding how you become operationally more lean, whatever the case is in terms of cutting costs, there needs to be a message with that for people to not scrutinize it more closely.
Yeah.
The other thing I worry about, when you start comparing yourself to a Corolla, you better be careful. Because
I don't think they did that comparison. I think Bloomberg made that comparison,
okay,
just to
fair be enough, fair. Fair enough. But if we are going to go that route, just for argument's sake, I mean, just look at all of the recall issues that have recently stemmed for Tesla right now. And that's where some of this pricing stuff worries me as well. Because they've already demonstrated that when you get a Tesla, it kind of feels like
perfect.
An unfinished product.
Yeah.
You know?
The
NHTSA calls them recalls. He calls them over-the-air updates.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get into that terminology debate. But when you send out like 400 of those and over the course of a couple of years, that's a lot.
Yeah.
Like, to me, that gets me worried about, are we cutting corners from a safety perspective when we're putting these vehicles together in order to scale up, in order to keep prices down? And again, that's damaging. Let's also not forget that about 15 years ago, we had three people in suits driving to Washington to sit in front of people to help explain why their companies were going bankrupt and how they kept producing vehicles at a loss.
Yeah.
Let's hope Tesla's not going that way as well.
Yeah. It's weird because as Tesla brings the price down, I feel like I get closer and closer to the point personally where it's like, okay, I can sort of make the plunge and try a Tesla, right? And I feel like it's getting close to that price point where I would feel comfortable doing that. And maybe it's the same for many other people. But I don't know, because there is this weird element of sort of like the negative stigma that comes along with everything Elon Musk touches right now, that people might be scared off a little bit. You know, they might not. I mean, people want to make choices with their money. And sometimes they don't want to help fund the guy who thinks he's the smartest guy in the room, you know?
Yeah. Well, the thing that still gets me with Tesla a little bit, when you're comparing it to another, like a Toyota or a GM or whomever, I still feel a great deal of comfort in being able to take that to a dealership or to a repair shop that is familiar with that vehicle or well-versed in it. With Tesla, yes, we do have a Tesla place here in town, but how much further when you're traveling do you need to potentially go to find somebody who can help you?
Yeah.
If something goes wrong with the brakes, the lighting, whatever the case may be, I think that should be where Tesla's trying to figure some stuff out a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and we kind of talked about it, but we see in Tesla's earnings, like sales rose in Q3 27%, but the company still fell short of analyst estimates because of these price cuts and because of factory downtime. Are we going to see this as a continuing trend where sales are going to continue to go up, but do you think they'll be operating at a loss?
I don't know, but what's scary to me is, you know, like Jeff was intimating that there's like, you know, reactions to the stress of having to meet these goals, right? If your stakeholders and shareholders become unhappy because of the lower margins and you're not making money, then there you could see some things going sideways fast with like how they're trying to respond to that, because that pressure comes on fast and it's really intense for these companies.
It's a very delicate dance in terms of trying to serve every master. So in order to hit some of these numbers, the company is going to need to finish big by the end of the year. In order to hit CEO Elon Musk's stated goal of increasing sales 50% annually, they're going to have to sell 1.97 million vehicles this year. And through the first 9 months of this year, Tesla has delivered 1.3 million vehicles. So got to make about, you know, 700,000 more vehicles. And let's just say the analysts are not on the side that where they believe that's going to happen. I think they're guessing it's going to be a miss. But all right. Well, our next most popular story this week, 94-year-old toilet maker closing up shop. Mansfield Plumbing Products has a 94-year legacy in Perrysville, Ohio. Founded in 1929, the company is the fourth largest employer in the county and makes toilets and sinks. According to the Mansfield News Journal, The company recently announced plans to close the factory on December 31st, 2023, cutting some 277 employees in the process, about 220 of which are represented by the Teamsters. The company says severance and health insurance will be available to impacted employees, though it is based on tenure and seniority. Mansfield Plumbing hopes to offer job placement services as well. Roman Rampanini, Vice President of Commercial Operations in North America, said despite their best efforts and ongoing investments, production was unsustainable due to current economic conditions. Corona, the South American China manufacturer that bought the company 19 years ago, does plan on maintaining Mansfield's customer base, but the work is going to shift to the company's North and South American manufacturing facilities. And these are always odd stories because we're talking about manufacturing facilities with such a legacy and rich history in a community that is just suddenly uprooted. And it's, you know, for me, I always find it interesting looking back on the history of the company that I've never heard of before, but it's always the end of the story is always sad. Wow. Cause it's just like, well, it's, no, I mean, it's it is. It's just like,
over to you, Anna.
It's a great setup. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
So Anna, was it sad for you too? No. Well, either way, so it's an unfortunate situation. Do you think these jobs are being moved? Is it just simple cost cutting? I know a lot of people on the website wanted to point at the Teamsters and start blaming unions. Is it just a matter of Corona is well diversified in North and South America and they can do this cheaper at other facilities?
I'm not going to start blaming anybody. We don't know for sure. It was a little hard for me to believe that there's not like a forever market for toilets.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't know how to say that in any other way, but like, and obviously this is a little nuanced, but I wish we had gotten more from Mansfield than unsustainable production due to current economic conditions.
Yes.
Because you can say that, but what does that really mean when you're referring to plumbing related supplies? Because you know, that's an industry that I think is more so than most pretty recession resistant.
Yeah.
To begin with. And then add to the fact that, you know, new home starts have been stagnating a little bit due to interest rates. But the residential remodel market is booming right now.
Mm-hmm.
I read some interesting stats put out by Grandview Research, and they said that the U.S. residential remodeling market size was estimated at $512 billion in 2022 and is expected to grow at a compound annual growth rate of 4.4% between now and 2030. Not to mention, some experts say that there's even more of a boost coming as homeowners who are carrying like record high equity levels in their homes start to remodel more with some of that cash that they have to play with. There's a certain number of houses that they pointed to are like reaching, there's like a tipping point, I guess, between 20 and 40 years where everyone remodels their entire house. So just a heads up, if you guys.
I'm not doing anything you
have to do
related.
You have to do it.
No.
The fence was just a start.
The fence, yeah. We put in a fence, everything's over. I got a 10-year window.
So anyway, because of all that, Eric Finnegan, who's the VP of Research and Demographics at John Burns Real Estate Consulting, told Yahoo Finance in an interview that a historic boom was coming. So like, think about how hard it is to get a contractor now.
Mm.
Get ready. So people need toilets is my point.
Yeah.
And I don't know what's happening here. I mean, more than likely, I think what he does not say is probably that this does have to do with wage rates. And it was, you know, it was telling to me that the operational displacement is being picked up in Corona's North and South American manufacturing plants, which I read as this production is probably going to Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
That's an assumption, but perhaps what's not sustainable for the company is just U.S. wage rates, and they want to increase their margins by doing it elsewhere. I don't know for sure, but to say that economic conditions, I mean, like, what else are you talking about besides wage rates?
Just come out and say it. They made the toilets too good.
Maybe
no one's replacing their toilets because they're too good.
They're too good. I don't know what the price of porcelain is right now.
Yeah.
Maybe it's high.
Yeah.
but anyway, there's definitely a market for sinks and toilets forever, but especially now.
Mm-hmm.
So it is kind of hard to believe that they're like, yep, sorry, we can't do this.
Well, it made me think of a plant that they closed in nearby Big Prairie, Ohio in 2020. And that made a lot more sense, right? Because they were focusing on making more efficient toilets. And this is a plant in particular that made a very specific flush mechanism. And it just was obsolete. So that makes sense to me, right? Whereas to say like, yeah, you know what, Jeff? World's just not going to need toilets
People
anymore.
Don't need them. Yeah. People don't use them.
Well, one of the things that the Mansfield touts is their relationship with Lowe's. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go on the Lowe's website, you look for toilets, there's like 20 to 25 options in terms of different companies, okay? Yeah. So if you're looking through there, more people browse online and everything else, what names stand out to you? Kohler, Moen, some of these others. Mansfield's probably not the first one that jumps out at you if you're a homeowner, okay, looking to do a project.
What's your maybe top even, toilet, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, look, here's the other thing. In looking at their product category, their product line, it looks like, by all reports, it's well-engineered, well-designed, well-made, all of those things, but it sort of falls in that middle tier of it's not the cheapest option out there. It's not just basically throw it in and go.
Yeah.
It's not the one that, you know, is self-cleaning with a bidet and everything else on. I mean, there's some of these toilets that are going for like $2,500, okay? So it's not either one of those extremes. It's somewhere in the middle, and I think there's a lot of options in that middle ground. So it becomes super competitive. I think this was a choice by the parent company to just say, we're stagnant. Mm-hmm. Let's just get out of here and put our resources in a different product category where maybe there's less competition. They have a bigger brand name, whatever the case may be. That's what it felt like to me because, just like Anna said, I am not buying the economic conditions element.
Yeah.
Residential and commercial construction is still increasing and growing. So there's opportunities there. It just felt like we don't want to do this anymore, and we're going to find out with some very vague vanilla language to throw out there to try to justify it. You feel horrible for this town, these 270 people. It seems like a tough decision that was made at a high level.
Yeah, just come out and say, hey, we make plates, all right? We acquired some toilets 5 years ago. It turns out we make plates really well. One thing was that, what was the story that, you did last week about the 100-year-old manufacturer?
Oh yeah. Morse Manufacturing. Yep.
Yeah. About Morse Manufacturing. So, that was the story that actually spurred somebody to reach out and say like, hey, you should do a story about our manufacturing company, closing. And it was just,
Morse is not closing. No.
Okay. Oh,
sorry.
No. That was the tips from the 100-year-old manufacturer.
Yeah.
No.
No, to be clear.
Yeah,
Morse is doing great. It was an interview with their CEO about how great they're doing. You're right. Is it with the Utz plant?
Yeah, the Utz plant. Yeah. The 100-year-old Utz plant. And that was, you know, a lot of times we do these stories and, you know, we have numbers like, you know, 300 employees, but we never have a face to go with any of those. Mm-hmm. And to have someone reach out individually and just say like, hey, this is happening to us too in Ohio, and we had never heard of it. You know, when news breaks in the industry, we can't cover it all. So I just encourage more people to reach out so that way we can help either give a little bit more exposure to it, try and get a little bit more details around it, or just, you know, report on it so that way maybe some other people can learn about it as well. One thing I was curious about, and I'd be interested in getting both your takes on this. So, Anna, one thing they said is that, you know, 277 people are going to lose their jobs at the end of the year, but they're hanging on to like a handful of people to kind of like close up shop, right, through August of next year. What do you think it's like to be on those skeleton crews where it's just like, okay, 99% of your colleagues are gone and it's just you and five other people making sure the plumbing doesn't burst, essentially?
Is that a rhetorical question?
Well, I'm curious. Like, I mean, like, what do you think, how much of an incentive would you need in order to stay on and kind of like hang on for the next 8 months, essentially working by yourself?
Well, I mean, it's probably like, you know, if you don't have another job lined up and you want to like hang out and look for one.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's probably like a pretty miserable place to be, but.
Yeah, we've actually had readers respond. I think we've posed this question before, and we've heard from some folks who've been in that situation, and I think their initial outlook was kind of like you said, like, oh, this is a cakewalk. We're just shutting the place down, sitting around a little bit. But the longer that it went on, the more difficult it became to go there and go through that routine of whatever it was on a day-to-day basis to check the boxes and be there.
Yeah.
Pretty emotionally draining, I would think, to have to be in that position.
Yeah. And you are right. We have posed this question before. I'm already recycling. I apologize. We got to keep it fresh. I can't even, like, blame, you know, like, painkillers because I don't have any good ones yet. All right. Our most popular story this week. Kia calls new EV SUV a, quote, wake-up call to the industry. Kelley Blue Book says the average new vehicle price in the United States is $48,000, up about $10,000 since before the pandemic. Kia apparently took consumer costs into consideration when deciding the starting price for its new 2024 Kia EV9, the automaker's first three-row electric SUV. The EV9 will come standard with DC fast charging, leather interior, 19-inch alloy wheels, heated seats, and space for up to seven passengers. And it's going to start at $54,900. It's a price that Kia thinks is low enough to force other automakers to follow suit. Steven Senner, Executive VP and Chief Operating Officer for Kia America, called the price a, quote, wake-up call to the industry, saying a well-equipped three-row SUV EV doesn't have to be prohibitively expensive. In terms of three-row SUV EVs, that is just a mouthful. The EV9 beats the VinFast VF9, the Rivian R1S, and the Volvo EX90 on price, though not necessarily on specifications. In terms of three-row gas-powered SUVs, the EV9 starts at a lower point than the 2024 Ford Expedition and the 2024 Toyota Sequoia. Anna, is the EV9 SUV EV a wake-up call to the industry?
I don't know. Not to me. I did not take that away from this. The $55K starting price doesn't exactly blow me away.
Yeah.
I know three-row SUVs are expensive, but I think the problem is that Kia isn't really distinguishing between this EV price and the price that Americans are used to paying for a three-row SUV. I know you mentioned the Expedition and the Sequoia. Okay. But there's a lot of gas SUVs that are three rows that are strong brands, and they're priced less than that. The Chevy Tahoe starts under 50K. The Jeep Grand Cherokee starts under 50K. The Toyota Highlander does. And it's this classic challenge I think that automakers have. You can't just target your messaging to EV buyers. I think that you have to target all buyers if you want to move the needle on EV sales. So make the EV price a game changer for compared to gas SUVs, then you have my attention. But right now, I don't think that they did that. It doesn't make a splash, in my opinion, because it's over $50,000. You can get gas vehicles for cheaper. What's new? Like, yeah. That's where we already are. To me, there's other things in play as well. And I think Jeff disagrees with me on this, but Kia as a brand, they've made some progress over the years. I will give them that. But Statista puts Kia's brand perception ranking in the U.S. as number 10 in 2023. Kelley Blue Book put Kia at number 6 in non-luxury brands. So that doesn't even include Volvo and the like in that comparison.
Yeah, VinFast and Rivian.
Right.
Yeah.
But it still puts Kia below legacy brands like Ford, Toyota, Chevy, and Honda. And I also wager to guess that people have been put off a little bit by the highly publicized Kia theft narrative that Hyundai and Kia have been unable to snuff out for 3 years now.
Yeah.
To the point where they're like settling lawsuits over it. So I don't know. To me, with like, so you're a company that has a brand image that's sort of in the middle. Mm-hmm. It's less prestigious than some of your competition. People maybe expect a lower price. You know, it makes sense to me that nobody is being floored by a brand that's seen as kind of middling. It's a reasonable price, I guess, but it's not like that's how it should be. It's not blowing me away.
Yeah. I'm surprised that you say middling even, because for me, Kia is like bottom.
I think, to me, it was for a long time, but I do think they've made some progress in the last few years because they put out a lot of new models.
Yeah.
And they've really kind of upped their game in terms of, I think their quality has improved, and they've kind of upped their game with some of their body designs. They're just a little bit, they're getting there. But
so who's under them then?
Some of them, I think.
I'm just curious.
Yeah, they're challenging because it's like they look at brand perception like, would you consider buying this brand?
Yeah.
And I think when you're looking at vehicles, that stuff is not always apples to apples. You're going to pay more for a Volkswagen than you are a Chevy. Like, that's just a different, that people identify differently with those brands. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's almost like demographics comes into play there. And so I don't know how they do it exactly apples to apples.
Yeah.
But I do think that, yes, Kia is not certainly at the top of that list for a lot of people.
Well, I mean, so for me, my interpretation was that the Kia brand needs a wake-up call. And I mean, maybe this, the EV9 is the wake-up call that might kind of turn some heads. But for me, it wasn't personally, Jeff. So I don't know, is the EV9 and this price point, is it enough to kind of give you a different perspective of Kias in your mind? Or is it, you know, is this what it's going to take to see you in a Kia?
Well, first of all, you guys are both 1,000% inaccurate in your perceptions of Kia.
It's okay? Our perceptions, yeah. Jeff.
But they're just wrong.
Why is
they're
it
bad.
Wrong?
No, they're bad.
So
they're horrible.
I said bottom.
It's an inoperable perception, David. No, here I understand what you're. I mean, you're right. It's a totally an individual take on all this stuff when it comes to a brand name. But Kia has done a ton. If you start doing research, comparing vehicles and things like that. From a safety reliability perspective, they've improved significantly over the last 5 to 10 years. Okay, so they have built up a stronger reputation in a base customer there. When I looked at this vehicle, I was shocked at how good it looked. The lines, the design, everything else. I think it does blow away a lot of other vehicles. Forget if they are EVs or gas-powered, sort of in that three-seat SUV model dynamic. Okay, mm-hmm. I think it's just got a really cool look. And when I was comparing it to vehicles like what we drive, like the Buick Enclave or others like that, it looks better and it is cheaper and it's got a lot more power than you would typically associate with that brand of vehicle. When you look at what it can put up from a horsepower, from a towing perspective, and then you look at the inside and it is really nice, much nicer than I think the perception has been about Kia. I think in the past, it's like, it's stripped down, it's your basic get to, you know, go from point A to point B type of vehicle. I think this does a lot to move past that, which Kia has been doing over the last couple of years.
Yeah, okay? Like Kia's known as the last with the hand crank windows.
That I was not.
No. I mean, I'm just. But when we're talking about perception or whatever, so.
But I think that's one of the things. And just to keep going here, that's one of the things this vehicle will help do.
Yeah.
It'll help tell people look at other Kia vehicles because they have come a long way in the last decade to get past that dynamic in terms of what they're doing. What I don't understand is why car makers, I think, are the most guilty of this. Why are you talking about your competition?
Yeah.
Just talk about you.
Yeah.
And why would you say, well, this is a wake-up call to the industry? Everybody look at us and see what we're... No. Forget about Ford and GM and Toyota and Rivian and whoever else you want to talk about.
Yeah.
Just talk about you. Yeah. Because I think right now, consumers are going to take so much more... I think a lot more time, actually, than they would have in the past in comparing vehicles and checking out every feature and benefit because you are paying so much more for them. And because there is this big choice between going electric versus a gas combustion engine. So, yeah. Like I said, I think it comes a long way. I don't know that it's a wake-up call. I don't like that term. But I think this could do a lot to put Kia in a different mindset for a lot of vehicle buyers.
So that's what I meant, like a brand wake-up call.
Where so it's you're not, playing both sides now.
No, so it's you're not waffling. It's not a
are
wake-up
you wobbling
call for
cause
the
of your
industry.
Knee? It doesn't let you stand
I can't,
in one spot.
I can't, don't have the stability to wobble, Jeff. If I start to wobble, I fall on Anna.
Sit down like, on your chair here.
I have the emergency chair just in case wobbling is about to happen. A wake-up call for consumers, not necessarily the industry. Because, I mean, you're right. When you look at the EV9, it is something unlike you would ever expect from Kia. But based on that legacy, do you even get somebody in the door to look at it because they just don't want a Kia?
I think you do now. Okay. Yeah. Maybe a decade ago when the purchasing dynamic, the process was different because prices were lower, there was more vehicles available, all of those things. Now I think when you start going and comparing them and looking at, okay, all right, it doesn't have this, but it does have this, and it does have this, I think while that brand name is important, I'm not trying to sidestep that, I think you're going to open a lot of eyes when people start looking. If I want a third row SUV, this one pops up into your Google search. Yeah, I think it is going to be a real changer potentially for Kia in terms of the price point. The price point, I think, is good.
All right. Well, Before we move on to In Case You Missed It, we have another word from our sponsor. This week's episode is brought to you by Rockwell Automation, which wants to help you gain unlimited HMI visualization options. This new video podcast, now available on demand, highlights Rockwell's recent rollout of FactoryTalk Optics, a new cloud-enabled HMI product. According to the company, this latest offering centers on improving processes, efficiency, and deliverables by providing new levels of collaboration, scalability, and interoperability. In this podcast, Anna and Jeff break down the webinar. Register now. All right, let's move on to, in case you missed it, the stories that maybe weren't as popular on the websites, but still stand to make a big impact on the industry going forward. Anna, let's start with you. What is your In Case You Missed It this week?
Sure. The story I selected was titled, America's Farmers Are Getting Older. We ran this story, I think, because it has some pretty serious implications for the food supply chain and ultimately for all of us who would see a shortage of agricultural production due to workforce constraints impacting prices, right? Mm. So the article states that there is ongoing concern over the average age of U.S. farmers, which as of now is 57 and a half years old. And the report says the country isn't doing enough to recruit younger farmers. They cite the barriers to entry, including capital if you don't inherit a farm or have somebody, you know, legacy in your family to get you going. The stress of external variables like weather, price volatility of goods. But the other is that rural farming life is just hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard. It's a ton of work. And that's one thing I want to point to when we discuss all this automation that's hitting the scene and the agricultural industry applications that we see from some of that stuff. Like, we've seen autonomous tools like tractors, crop dusting planes and the like. We're seeing AI tools that can apply really precise accuracy to harvest timing or predicting disease in a crop. I think there are a lot of things that are in development for agriculture that reduce the stress of operating a farm and also the physicality of it. So I think when we talk about this stuff, we can't stress enough the importance of some of these really purpose-built applications in ag that can be used as a tool maybe to bring some new people in, which is a critical requirement for the food industry that relies so heavily on their work. And, you know, again, like, this is not an easy yes for a lot of young people these days who can, you know, make money another way. This is like getting up with the sun, man. But like,
but it's the hardest yes.
It's the hardest. Yeah, it's one of the hardest jobs out there. And, you know, people need to feel compelled to do it. But if we can make it easier on your body and less volatile and just less costly for some of these farmers, I think, you know, that's great. So that's why we cover these types of stories in automation that apply to tractors or other implements and things like that, because it's just so important that that stuff gets made and used.
Well, I also want to stress the importance, particularly coming from the Midwest, of the work ethic that is the foundation for workers, for Midwestern workers. And I think a lot of it goes back to farming and people that have had agricultural jobs in their past. I know that I'm speaking from my past and the past of people who I grew up with. And it is just a different level. Like, people that have worked on farms in any capacity have just a different gear when it comes to being able to put their head down and go to work. And, you know, that's one thing I'm afraid of, like, people kind of losing that base where you kind of understand, like, losing that, where you learn that about yourself, where you can like dig deep and work hard, even if it's dirty, even if it is physically taxing. But it is very rewarding, because as you talk about the food supply chain, like, you're feeding everybody. And, you know, I talk about that a lot, like having, you know, a sense of worth based on what you're creating. And I mean, at a very base level, like, I think just under toilets is food for everybody in terms of like making sure you're making a product everybody needs. And I was actually surprised when I saw that the age was 57. Jeff, for you, was that younger than you thought? I thought
no. Yeah. I mean, this isn't a shock. You know, growing up in a small farming community, I mean, this is something I saw coming out of high school.
Yeah.
Because not everybody who grew up on a farm wanted to stay on a farm.
Yeah.
A lot of the reasons you guys have mentioned, but also just because the economics behind it have gotten so much harder. Look at milk prices lately. They've gone down. So if you've run a dairy farm in Wisconsin, it's tougher to get by on with a mid-sized herd. You almost have to go to like this factory-sized farm. And that's where a lot of this automation that Anna's talking about comes into play. One of the, you know, I was talking with one of my buddies from back home, and one of our friends had actually recently, or not recently, about 8-10 years ago, invested in what was almost a $1 million milking system, fully automated. Now, this is a guy who's working in a town of 1,200 people. So this is your typical traditional family dairy farm. Mm-hmm. He did this because he knew if he was going to die milking cows, basically, if he did not do this, and he needed some sort of quality of life, made this investment, and he's doing extremely well from a business perspective. His business is well, and he's got a very happy and full life. So he's enjoying the best of both worlds. He grew up on the farm. He wanted to be a farmer, just didn't want to necessarily follow in that traditional route of working until you're 70 and then probably being gone 5 years after because you just kicked the crap out of yourself all this time keeping the farm going.
Yeah.
So all of this automation and all of these different advancements that we talk about, and I'll talk about it every chance I get, is so important moving forward to preserve this quality of life, this type of life, and also what's being produced on all these farms, because we are otherwise going, the alternative is essentially becoming factory farms.
Yeah.
Which would be unfortunate from, I think, a quality perspective in some instances, but also just a way of life. You talk about work ethic. Mm-hmm. There is no greater problem solver than a farmer. Mm-hmm. I mean, with all of the different variables thrown at them to try to get in their way of getting, if you want to use a manufacturing term, getting product out the door.
Yeah.
No one has to solve more stuff on a daily basis than a farmer.
Just don't look at how they put the electrical together sometimes.
It works.
Is there, it works. Don't touch that. It's raining.
Careful.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, you also, with the new advancements in technology, you get to cover more stories about, was it the lasers that like shoot birds that are eating pests?
Yep.
I mean, you get more bird shooting lasers, and
absolutely,
that's just a fun day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jeff, what's your, in case you missed it this week?
So I also picked a food story, actually, and this one, this is, I mean, it really kind of plays off of a theme we've been talking about a lot here, and it's the American Bakers Association is warning of a looming workforce shortage. So again, we're looking in the baking industry, so it's literally your daily bread we're talking about here. And they're talking about over the next couple decades having a shortage of like 50,000 workers in these facilities.
Whoa.
Now, there's a lot of different dynamics at play here, right? First of all, we've seen, and we've talked about this before, when you look at food manufacturing and food production, margins are tight. Yeah. So now when we look at increased labor pressures in terms of the cost for labor, more competitive pressures coming from restaurants or retail outlets and things like that competing for some of these jobs, it's tough. So to get quality workers, you need to pay them more. That cuts into profits, or it drives up prices, or it creates supply chain issues. So this is a really significant issue. I mean, we talk about the skills gap. We talk about not having enough manufacturing workers. Man, we're literally talking about bread here.
Yeah.
Okay. So this could be a huge issue if we don't figure some things out. Now, they're talking about automation and what's going on there. Consolidation is a potential opportunity, but really the geography, it's very evenly dispersed. By 2030, the number of jobs that they're going to be short in these facilities. So solutions are needed. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. What I think we're going to see is continued price increases for a lot of what we've always considered commodity food items, like bread, like milk, potentially. And it all comes back to, again, not having enough people in the facilities making the product and getting it out the door.
Can these facilities afford to further automate just with the margins so tight? I mean,
it's a yes and no type of question, or response, I should say, because there's so much there's been so much legacy technology used in these facilities. They've been a little bit of a laggard, not all of them, but when you look at some of the smaller facilities, they have definitely not been early adopters. So now that's one of the things that the pandemic sort of forced upon a lot of these places. Also, if you're going to sell to bigger food service companies or to bigger, you know, a Mondelez or anybody like that, there's a lot more auditing and third parties that are coming and saying, you need to have this type of technology in place so that we can do quality checks, so that we can make sure if there's a recall, you can trace this back and find out the bad batch and identify it. It's more traceability in the supply chain, which has sort of been sort of a reverse direction. You're almost starting with the product coming out the door in terms of getting more and more technology and automation into these facilities, which will help quell some of these concerns. But you're still talking about food, and there's still a lot of manual processes that need to be taken because quality is so important, and because you have to measure out exacting amounts, and because you need to be sure that there is, you know, not just 10 pepperonis on the pizza, but they're in the right places.
Yeah. So
there is a lot more to it from a manual inspection perspective that is going to be tricky going forward.
Anna, are we going to be saved from this particular shortage because during the pandemic, most people learned how to make their own bread?
I did not, though.
Oh, I was not, you're sunk.
I know. And the Midwest is the region with the most unfilled jobs.
Yeah.
That's concerning. Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, I think this is a good reminder that when people look at those big, you know, job shortages in manufacturing, it's like a huge number. But then you kind of think about, like, well, what's manufacturing? It's spread out. Mm-hmm. You know, I think people forget about the food aspect of it, of what that would mean if we were at, what the impact of that would mean if we were at such a deficit. That's like food shortages territory, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just like you have to wait an extra week to get your TV from Samsung or something. You know, it's just
it's that there is no food.
Yeah. So there are like some industries like this where the impact of a workforce shortage is monumental. It's huge. And in this case, yeah, bread. Bread's a big one.
Yeah. Well, they didn't underplay it at all. In a statement regarding the study, ABA, the American Bakers Association, President and CEO Eric Dell said, quote, "The data speaks for itself and is a chasm that threatens the very foundation of our industry and requires immediate and collective action." I mean, that is urgent.
I mean, Anna, how could your daughter have toast for supper?
There's
no bread.
Yeah, my daughter eats only bread and apples. So we got to keep those going.
I'll show you how to make bread. It's not that bad. You got to be way more patient, though.
Oh.
And it can go south real fast. Real fast. All right. My, in case you missed it this week, was regarding a whistleblower. Eli Lilly has finally settled a lawsuit with a former human resources officer regarding a simply wrong situation, according to the company. In a lawsuit, Amrit Mulla claimed that she was fired for identifying poor manufacturing practices and falsified data at a New Jersey plant. According to Reuters, this human resources officer allegedly told managers at the plant, which makes several drugs like diabetes treatment Trulicity, to fix the problems. According to Mulla, managers not only said that she was, quote, simply wrong, but also dismissed her and just called her a non-scientist. The pharmaceutical giant was running out of time to finalize the settlement after a tentative agreement, which it reached a couple of months ago. Come on! And it looks like the two parties finally came to terms. Eli Lilly admitted no wrongdoing and won't comment on the settlement. And kind of surprisingly, the former employee is rather tight-lipped too. However, it does look like Mulla wasn't entirely wrong. FDA inspectors have found a number of problems at the plant, like unaudited quality control data that had been deleted and drug batches that were thrown away without proper internal investigation to prevent future problems. The company does say it is working with the FDA. I chose the story for a number of reasons. One is because I immediately was against the employee because it was a human resources officer. And when they said she was simply wrong and a non-scientist and didn't belong back there talking about it, I was like, yeah, what are you doing back there? Stay in your office. Write this, you know, hand out the demerits. But then when you look into the story and it looks like, A, there's a lot there that the FDA found in terms of wrongdoing. And I don't know. I think that there are some industries, and the pharmaceutical is one of them. Pharmaceutical industry is one of them where you just expect that there's this level of good manufacturing practices and like elite level safety and above board practices. And, you know, it's stories like this that kind of bring me back that, you know, just because you hope they're doing it right and they're in charge of drugs like Trulicity for treating diabetes, that, you know, there's always that human element that comes into play and there's wrongdoing. And so it's courageous of people like this Amrit Mulla to kind of come out, blow the whistle on this, so that way, you know, something really, really bad can come out from bad drug interactions that aren't manufactured properly, aren't QC'd properly. And I don't know, I give her a lot of credit, which is why I wanted to give her a little bit more exposure. Anna, your thoughts on what happened at Eli Lilly?
Yeah, concerning. And I think it kind of reinforces this nature that you sometimes get in really any workplace, that there's like a pecking order. And it seemed like maybe this culture of elitism here, where they were not going to take, a nod from somebody that wasn't on their team.
Yeah.
That's concerning, I think, in a lot of ways, because you have to consider that, you know, running a company is kind of an all hands on deck thing. And if somebody sees something that doesn't look right to them, they have to feel like they have a way of sharing that information without being like, I don't know, humiliated, honestly, yeah, by like somebody calling you a name. And that's not the culture that you want to breed at your facility. If it turns out that person truly doesn't understand what that process is doing, and maybe they are simply wrong, fine, but like, yeah, you shouldn't prevent people from bringing concerns to light.
Yeah, they should feel empowered to, you know, look at a bunch of boxes of drugs that were thrown away and go, why? And, what was exactly wrong here? Jeff, I know that you've covered pharmaceutical quite a bit in the past as well. I mean, is it another margin game when it comes to stuff like this? Or is it speed to market, all of the above, when it comes to, you know, some of these pharmaceutical manufacturers? And like a pharmaceutical giant, right? Eli Lilly, who, of all people that you would think maybe it would be a gold standard, would be like an Eli Lilly. But maybe I'm confused in that too.
No, margins aren't as big a concern in pharma. I mean, they're pretty good at building in margins to that.
Yeah.
I think this is more of one of those things where when you look at pharma, they have their GMP, their good manufacturing processes, or their practices, where it's very clear. Mm-hmm. There is no, we don't round the corners here. This is all 90 degree turns. And I think when you get some people on a production floor like, look, I get it. I know I'm just going to do this and then we'll come back to it, make it right. Don't worry about it. And somebody sees that once and they're like, okay, you're going to make that right?
Mm-hmm.
And they see it twice, maybe a third time, then you have to say something, especially, yeah, like you said, you're dealing with drugs here, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
So, this isn't just, you know, bad plastic parts or something. This is different. It's a different dynamic. So I think this leads back to a lot of cultural issues probably at this particular facility. And you're right. Hats off to Mula here for, how do you say her?
Amrit Mula.
Amrit Mula.
Yeah.
For stepping forward. And yeah, I mean, because that could not have been easy to voice those concerns. And she had to do it more than once.
I don't know if it's bullying, but they were like clearly very mean to her, trying to shut her down.
You know,
like,
stay in your place, know your role type of thing.
Yeah. When she's just asking, why are the drugs in the garbage? Like, or whatever it was.
Basically, it was. Right. Yeah.
All right. Well, before we get out of here this week, let's move on to our final thoughts. Anna, what's your final thought this week?
I've got a big weekend ahead. Our twins are turning 6 and they're having a combined birthday party.
All right.
With their friends. This is our first friends party. It's getting a little bit, there's been a little bit of birthday party creep. It's getting just like bigger and bigger by the day. We have a lot of really fun activities planned, but one thing that I'm a little nervous about is there's been this pinata precedent set in our friend group.
Yeah, the pinata precedent, yeah, 23.
I know. So they're like, we need to have a pinata. And I'm like, fine. So I have a pinata. But like 6-year-olds, man, like the bat, I don't know. I'm afraid of what's going to happen. It's been raining like crazy. It's going to be like this probably like very muddy area.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You're not doing a pinata in your house?
No, it's going to be outdoors. It's going to be outdoors. Wish me luck at making this go forward as planned in an organized fashion. I don't know.
So what can you say? What is inside the pinata?
Oh, candy.
Is it just candy?
Raisins.
My girls were on the tail end of this whole thing. I didn't know if you put toys in there or like
smoothies.
It's gonna rain
ice cream. That'd be awesome. Ice cream in there.
Yeah.
No, it's all candy, which I'm sure all of the parents are gonna really appreciate.
Yeah. Well, I hope that it stays wet, and then like, in a way to engineer himself out of the problem, your husband like maybe puts down like stakes down a tarp underneath it that then gets wet and turns into like a slip and slide.
Yeah.
That the kids are holding a bat and trying to swing on. It's gonna be fun.
It's gonna be like a Tough Mudder. pinata edition for a bunch of like 5 and 6 year olds. So it's going to be probably hilarious.
Yeah, they'll just build a small human pyramid, get feral, start chewing holes in it like, we need the candy. No, that's when you said birthday party creep, I was just like, oh, there's who's the creeper? Like, are you getting a clown?
Oh, no, I did not hire a creep. No, I just meant like that just more elements and people just keep getting added to it. And it's just going to, now there's like a ton of people coming and lots of components.
Yeah.
The lady there to paint people's faces. So Jeff, if you're not doing anything, you can pick from like all these different designs. So it's up to you.
I will be exploring the beautiful city of Dubuque, Iowa this weekend. So unfortunately, I can't make it.
A fine town.
I could, you know, I would be available to like camo them up. Like I've still got some old camo from the Army if they wanted to, you know.
Yeah, okay. if we run out of time. We've got 2 hours with her, but.
Wow. No, it's, Anna, it doesn't sound like you're throwing a birthday party so much as like a fall festival now.
It's become the neighborhood fall festival. Yes.
Well, it'll be a good time.
But it's for two kids, so that's what I keep being like. But it's two people's birthday party. Yeah, so that's why
double the party. My final thought this week is I just wanted to say thank you to Jeff and Lindsay, who reached out separately when we were talking about movies about what you bring back. What you bring back with you from outer space and the implications it might have on Earth. And they recommended the movie The Andromeda Strain, which was the 1971 version was incredible. Really enjoyed it. It was just good, classic sci-fi cinema. And, you know, I just, like I do anything that I enjoyed, I really got into the weeds about, like, how the book was written and Michael Crichton's career trajectory as a result and how it changed once The Andromeda Strain was great or a real hit. And the other part is that, did you see what we ran in the news today, in the newsletter today, about how NASA was showing off some of the asteroid sample that was like collected on top of the vessel? And if you read the story, it says like, they have not opened the capsule yet. That is the beginning of the Andromeda Strain. Like the beginning of it is they walk up and they're like, oh my God, they opened it. And it's just like, it couldn't be more timely. So I just wanted to thank Jeff and Lindsay for recommending The Andromeda Strain. Again, watch the 1971 version. There was like a mini series made not too long ago. And let's just say they took a couple liberties, the original story. And I've only watched like one of the episodes so far. But it was enough to be like, you know, maybe I don't need to continue. I don't need to continue this, but just out of interest, I'm going to. But yeah, I encourage you guys to check it out. It's just a fun time. So thanks again. Jeff, what's your final thought?
I just want to say thanks to Todd Wayant. He is the host of the Bridging the Gap podcast that went on there this week.
Nice.
Really interesting. It's a podcast focusing on talking about the construction industry and making connections to others and facing similar challenges. We talked about skills gap, innovation, new technology, all that stuff. It was, as far as the podcast that I've been on, Todd asked some of the more difficult questions. So some of them was definitely a give me a second and think about that a little bit. But it was a good dialogue, good conversation, and really enjoyed it and appreciated the opportunity to go on the show.
Edit out the long pauses.
I think, I hope so. Yeah.
One thing that I've been curious about is the use of cobots in construction. Like how I never thought of automation being used in some of the specific applications that are going into the construction industry, like how they have cobots, you know, driving screws for drywall into the ceiling. I mean, it's just crazy, you know. Yeah. But no, when is it out already, or is it?
I'm not sure when it's going to run.
Okay,
but yeah, we recorded this week, so. Definitely recommend taking a look at the podcast. They talk about a lot of interesting stuff on there. Definitely pertinent to the industrial sector as well.
Yeah, check it out and subscribe. All right. Well, before we get out of here, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, Anna, or David at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to our daily newsletter. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. And subscribe to us on YouTube at IEN Magazine so you can join us when we go live every Thursday. All right. For Jeff Franke and Anna Wells, I'm David Manti. This is the Today in Manufacturing podcast, and we'll see you next week.